is Virginia Reloaded, presented by Gun Owners of America, fighting for your rights in the Commonwealth and beyond.
Hello, people. My name is John Crump. I'm the Virginia Director of Gun Owners of America, Washington, D.C.'s only no-compromise gun lobby. This week on Virginia Reloaded, we have a very special episode. It's all dedicated to Nick Freitas. If you don't know who Nick Freitas is, he is a politician in the state of Virginia, a great, great delegate, and he is 100% 2A. He is a defender of 2A. He went viral a couple years ago because he gave a very impassioned speech on the floor of the House about the importance of the Second Amendment, and he was just sick of the other anti-gun politicians in the Virginia legislature attacking our God-given right to bear arms. And I had a chance to sit down and talk to him, and without further ado, let's go to the interview. All right, I am here with Nick Freitas out of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I first came to know Nick when I saw a video of him giving a very impassioned speech on the Second Amendment on the floor. And I think that's where a lot of people first knew him from. But even before that speech, he has given a lot for the state of Virginia and the Commonwealth. Nick, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you have a military background, correct?
Yes, I do. I do. Enlisted right out of high school. Went to infantry basic training over in Fort Benning, Georgia. Airborne school after that. Served with the 82nd Airborne Division for a few years, and then went over to the 25th Infantry Division over in Hawaii. And then 9/11 happened, like, gosh, 3 or 4 months after I got there. So volunteered for Army Special Forces, back to Fort Bragg, went through the qualification course, and then did a couple combat tours in Iraq with 1st Special Forces Group.
All right. Then after the military, you got out and you eventually ended up in the Virginia legislature. And from there, you have been really a staunch supporter of the Second Amendment. And that's one of the things that GOA concentrates on, is the Second Amendment. You gave a speech that went viral, like all around the internet, much farther than just Virginia, about the defense of the Second Amendment. Are you aware what speech I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, anytime Ted Nugent shares a speech, I'm aware of it. But that was in, I want to say it was the first week in March in 2018. And it was shortly after the Parkland shooting. But to kind of lay the groundwork, prior to that, I mean, I served on the subcommittee back when the Republicans actually controlled the House of Delegates. I served on the subcommittee that heard all of the gun legislation. And so, you know, I was treated to all sorts of anti-gun arguments from some that were, again, I think, honest in their intentions, but I just disagreed with their policy. And then there were others that, you know, regularly compared us to criminals or terrorists. And if we didn't vote for their gun bill, we wanted people to die. And then one day on the floor, I just had enough after a member of the House basically compared us to segregationists, that those of us that were resisting infringements on the Second Amendment were essentially akin to those that were resisting integration of schools. And quite frankly, it just pissed me off. I had had enough at that point. And so I got up and I gave about a 7-minute speech. And I really just tried to lay out the fundamentals of why we support the Second Amendment, because it's been so misrepresented. People act like we're just bought off by gun organizations, or we just have some sort of weird gun fetish, and that's the reason why we support the Second Amendment. And so I tried to lay out a good argument, but the part that really angered my colleagues was, I said I didn't appreciate being compared to a segregationist, when after all, it wasn't my party that, you know, supported slavery and fought against women's suffrage and locked up Japanese Americans in concentration camps and supported Jim Crow and supported segregation and supported mass resistance. And they did not appreciate being reminded of that. And it caused, I think, 4 of them to leave the floor in tears. and the entire caucus to request a 15-minute recess. And then for the next couple of days, I got to hear a bunch of speeches on how I was a mean, bad person and a racist and everything else. So, but yeah, at first we published the speech because, you know, the Richmond Times-Dispatch and a number of other people had misreported what I'd actually said. And we said, well, we got to get this out there so people actually hear the argument I made, not viewing it through the prism of the media. And next thing we know, we had a couple million views. And then by the time, you know, I don't know, a month or so down the road, we were up to like 30, 40, 50 million views. And we had been on Fox News and Sean Hannity and shown clips of it. And, you know, Ben Shapiro had shared it and Ted Nugent shared it. And so it took off at that point. But again, the whole purpose was not to, you know, it wasn't to offend anybody, except that some people find the truth offensive. And if you do, then I'm sorry. That's not my problem. But ultimately, it was about this idea that what the Second Amendment is really about. It's not about hunting. It's not about gun collecting. It's nothing like that. It's about each individual having an inherent right to be able to defend themselves, defend their property from criminal activity or just from oppression. And that it is a core component of freedom. It's not some you know, thing that you can't really truly experience freedom unless you actually have the means to be able to, or the ability to have the means to be able to protect yourself and to be able to protect your freedom. And if you look at the text of the Second Amendment, it's very deliberate. And it was put in there in such a way with the words that it has, with the meaning that it had in the context, because the founders were recognizing two things about the Second Amendment. A, free societies are maintained when free people have the ability to keep and bear arms. And B, you have an inherent right which precedes government to be able to defend yourself. And, you know, I just wanted to make sure that I was given a good argument and an argument that other people could use when explaining their position on the Second Amendment.
Yeah, a couple of years later, the legislature flipped and went from Republican control to Democrat control. Were you surprised by that flip?
We had the year before they took control, we had barely kept control by one vote. And so we knew that the trend was somewhat working against us. Sorry about that. We knew that the trend was somewhat working against us at that point. But when they did take control, I think the thing that really surprised me was not just that they took control, it was how far to the left they went the moment they did. Because all of us were treated to that same line saying, well, nobody wants to take your guns. Nobody. It's ridiculous when conservatives say somebody wants to take your guns. Nobody wants to do that. Well, we found out as soon as they had power that not only did some of them want to do that, almost all of them wanted to do that. Because if you look at the legislation, how it passed through the House, which was straight up gun confiscation. I mean, they said it wasn't confiscation, but they criminalized you for owning an AR-15. They criminalized you for owning a magazine over 12 rounds. And almost every single Democrat in the House of Delegates voted for it. And so that's what really frustrated me is this garbage line that nobody wants to take your guns. Yeah, a lot of people do want to take our guns. And unfortunately, they're not going to be honest with the American people about what it is they want or why they want it.
Do you think Bloomberg dumping millions into Virginia had anything to do with them being able to take over?
Yes. No, absolutely. He didn't just invest in legislative races. He also invested in Commonwealth's attorneys races. I think he invested in a couple of sheriff's races, but I know he did Commonwealth's attorneys. And it's because, look, he understands, as well as some of the other donors on that side of this issue, that if they really want to get what they want, which is confiscation, then they're going to have people that are pushing it at the federal, state, and local level. And they invested a great deal in Virginia in order to attempt that. And the only thing that prevented that bill from passing 2 years ago was that we had close to 30,000 people show up in Richmond. And it was amazing because they treated it like a state of emergency. I mean, when Richmond was being burned to the ground by protesters, it took them like, 24, 48 hours to call a state of emergency. But when it became obvious that 30,000 pro-Second Amendment advocates were coming to the Capitol, they declared a state of emergency like, I think, a day or two before, brought in additional police from all over the Commonwealth of Virginia, set fences up everywhere. And what happened? Well, 30,000 Second Amendment advocates showed up, most of them actually carrying, or a lot of them carrying. And what did they do? Well, they peacefully protested, and then they picked up their trash when they left. But they were the ones treated as if they were the threat. And again, that's what you see in the whole culture now within the new leadership within the House of Delegates down there. But if it hadn't been for them showing up and really, and all the localities too, we had over 100 localities in Virginia sign up, local boards of supervisors sign up to be sanctuary counties, essentially saying, look, we're not going to infringe on your Second Amendment rights. We're not going to, you know, help the state infringe on your Second Amendment rights. And despite the fact that the bill passed through the House, it got what we call carried over in the Senate. So they didn't really kill it. They just killed it for that session, because ultimately that is what they want to do. And you'll notice they didn't carry it this year. Why? Election year. House of Delegates is up for re-election this year, and they didn't want to have to campaign on Delegate Levine's bill. But I guarantee you, if they once again take the governor's mansion, the attorney general, the lieutenant governor, and they keep the House of Delegates, they will be right back with that sort of draconian anti-gun legislation.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I do see it coming back. They're going to keep on bringing it back until they get it passed. But like you said, it is an election year. Do you think that they're going to maintain control, or do you think it's going to swing back towards the good guy side?
I think we got a real good shot at taking it back. I think we got a real good shot at taking it back for a couple of reasons. One, they did run so far to the left. Again, it's not like they all campaigned on, hey, we're going to have some, you know, minor regulations changes, and we're going to require a few more things before you buy a gun. That's what they campaigned on. That is not how they legislated when they got into power. And people are very aware of it now, not just on the Second Amendment, but on a whole host of other issues, both, you know, social and economic and legal, where there people are saying, look, we don't trust them anymore. We've also recruited some really good candidates to run in some of the more difficult districts. And so I think we got a great shot at taking it back. But ultimately, that's going to be decided by the people. And to be perfectly honest, I'll just go ahead and air out a frustration of mine. We do have a lot of people that are passionate about the Second Amendment. But the bottom line is, if you want to defend the Second Amendment, well, then you have to make sure that we are recruiting, electing, and holding accountable representatives that actually believe in the Second Amendment. I don't mean they took a survey one day and checked off the box. I mean, when you ask them about the Second Amendment, you wait to see, do they actually give you a strong, philosophically rigorous, intellectually rigorous argument for why the Second Amendment exists? Because if it's just them checking a box, if it's just them giving you a platitude to get your vote, well, then I would just say right now, not only is that representative a charlatan, but if they're winning with that garbage, that's also on the voter. And so we've got to do a better job of making sure that the people represent us actually represent what we believe, not just say what we want to hear. But by the same token, once you find that person, if we're not going all out to make sure that they get elected, well, then it doesn't make any sense yelling at the minority party when we don't have the votes in committee, we don't have the votes on the floor, we cannot legally stop it. It makes no sense to scream at us when we actually are trying to do everything we can stop it, but we don't got the people necessary. We don't have the votes necessary to do it. And so what I'm hoping is people turn that frustration that they have with this infringement on their liberty into action, because that's who we're supposed to be as Americans and as Virginians. When we get angry, you know, we don't go out and burn a city down. We don't, you know, sit on our couch and yell at the TV. We don't send out an angry tweet and then not do anything else. We find practical ways to actually affect the sort of change that we want to see in order to protect our liberties. And this is the point where we're going to make a decision. We're going to make a decision. We either really believe in this and we're really willing to do what it takes to get out there, to vote, to inform other people. Because I will tell you, one of the biggest reasons why the left has gotten away with so many infringements on Second Amendment rights is because they've got popular culture behind them. And by popular culture, I mean Hollywood, I mean academia, I mean the mainstream media. But then on top of that, you have an enormous amount of ignorance concerning firearms. I mean, let's take the arguments that you see to ban firearms that are commonly used with respect to the amount of gun homicides every year or gun deaths every year. All right, now switch that around and insert cars. because there's more vehicular deaths every year than there are firearm deaths every year. And so imagine the same argument being used. Well, you know what? Look, these cars are incredibly dangerous, and we're going to have to confiscate any car that goes a certain speed or any car that looks a certain way. You know, we got to get rid of all those assault cars off of the freeways because too many people are dying, over 50,000 deaths. We've got to get rid of these, right? If they did that, most people would be like, you're out of your mind. And the reason why is because pretty much everybody, once they get to a certain age, has driven a car, right? They understand the value of it. They also understand that there is, you know, a trade-off anytime we're talking about freedom and government restriction. But people are familiar with that, and they recognize the benefit of it. Now, you look at the number of people that have actually handled a firearm, that have actually used a firearm, that have actually gone to the shooting range. That number is significantly lower. And one of the greatest things that we can do, because I've got members of my family and friend group that are pretty left-wing, except on the issue of guns. Why? Because they grew up with a healthy respect for them. They understand how they can be used for positive things. And so when somebody tries to scare them into believing that the gun is the problem, they're not convinced by that argument because they're familiar with it. And that's one of the greatest things that we can do with education on this issue is make sure that we take away the stigma by actually providing people with opportunities to know how to properly and effectively use a firearm and see it for what it is. It is a tool, and a tool can be used for bad things, and a tool can be used for good things. What we want is good people using a tool for good things. And if we really want to be able to make that argument, we've got to familiarize people with it. We've got to take away the stigma, this fear. I mean, if COVID has taught us anything, it's that the government will use fear in order to gain more power. And you see the same thing with gun rights.
All right. One of the questions I get a lot about you specifically, if people always ask me, why doesn't Nick Freitas run for governor? And I don't know. So why didn't you run for governor this time around? I mean, I'm serious. I get that question a lot. Why I think about it? What I think about it?
No, I appreciate it. I think, and I joke around with people. When people ask why did you run for office in the first place, I said, well, a person I thought was a friend of mine convinced me to do it. running for office was never in my life plan. Right? I wanted to be a soldier. Then I wanted to be a Green Beret. When I got out, you know, I wanted to be able to spend time with my family and work on projects that I cared about. I wanted to be involved in politics, but I didn't think I was going to run for office. And then I got in and I saw a situation where I was afraid that we were going to lose congressional seats in Virginia. And so I was asked to run for U.S. Senate. And so I did that. And then I got asked to run for Congress in the 7th District, which was an incredibly difficult district. And we had a lot of, you know, crazy stuff going on this year. And I was willing to do it. So for me, it's more about whenever I'm asked about something like this, my family actually, we diligently pray about this, right? I know everybody says that. It's become this cliche thing for conservatives to be like, well, I'll pray about it. Well, no, we really do. We take that seriously. And because again, my identity is not wrapped up in being in elected office. The only reason I put up with, all the stuff with office that I think most people, you know, don't like is because I care about the issues. I care about the country. And this year, look, I think we have some good people running for governor and AG and LG. I don't know. I want to be in the place where I can do the most good in order to defend and fight for the values that I believe in. If that's elected office or if that's a different office than I hold now, okay, but I never want the life goal to be to attain this particular office. I want to be in the position where I can do the most good for the things I care about.
All right, that makes sense. You ran for Congress, what you brought up in the 7th District. You ran against someone named Spamberger. When I went to bed that night, I figured that you were going to win. And then when I woke up and I saw that you did.
Yeah, we did too.
It was crazy. And it seems like you lost because of a found flash drive. A lot of people ask me what I think about that. Mm-hmm. So I want to get your opinion on that. Because I did talk to the person who found the flash drive. And what I found incredibly disturbing was his wife worked for the Spamberger campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So
there was a number of things that were let's just say irregularities about that election cycle. We had naked ballots being turned in, which is not supposed to happen with respect to absentee ballots. We had people that showed up to vote that were told they had already cast an absentee, and so they filled out a provisional. Well, some registrars counted the provisional, some registrars counted the absentee. We had that thumb drive with, I think it was close to 15,000 votes on it. From what I understand, there was another report which we've tried to confirm that there was more absentee ballots than could have actually been submitted that were actually requested. And so we brought on a whole legal team. There was a lot of people that were mad at me, like, you conceded, you gave up. I'm like, we fought this for 2 months after the election. We had our own lawyers. We were talking to lawyers associated with the Trump team, and we were doing everything we can to try to track down and get sufficient evidence to be able to take something to court. The problem is that it's difficult to do that. It's difficult to prove fraud. And so we went through everything, and that's not to say that, and we are still doing research, because regardless of the outcome of my election, there were things that happened in that election cycle that should not happen. And there are things that state legislatures should do with respect to voting rights, where we should always be concerned about two things. One, if you are legally qualified to vote in this country, it should be easy. It should be easy for you to vote if you're legally qualified to vote. And then two, we should protect the integrity of our elections. And a lot on the left always love to talk about, every time we want to say, like, a photo ID or a signature for an absentee, that you're suppressing the vote. Here's what suppresses the vote. When people become so convinced that the system is so easy to game, that fraud can get through, that they don't even show up to vote anymore because they don't believe in the process. That's also a form of voter suppression. And so we're continuing to work to find ways that we can actually shore up our election law to make sure that, again, it's easy to vote if you're legally qualified to vote, but then also there's common sense processes in place to make sure that somebody isn't engaging in rampant fraud. And things like a thumb drive being discovered with 15,000 votes on it. Now, you know, we looked into that. It from what we could tell, it looked like it, you know, the votes were actually legitimate. The problem was that there was chain of custody issues. There was everything else that calls into question. And every time we mention that, people come back and say, well, the State Board of Elections or the Department of Elections said that this is one of the most successful election cycles we've ever had with respect to integrity. It's like, oh, okay, so the government says that the government did a good job. Well, that's reassuring. No, we need to have things in place to actually make sure that we can protect the integrity of our elections so that things that happened in my race don't happen in the future, regardless of what the outcome was.
Yeah, it seems like originally they were all about voter fraud and everything and the election being stolen in 2016. But this time, if you question the election, they say that it's impossible. Do you find that kind of hypocritical?
Oh, it's completely intellectually dishonest. I mean, look, if you're looking for intellectual honesty and consistency within politics, you're going to be disappointed, because it's very difficult to find, and it's usually punished when it is. So you see this all across the board. And one of the things that we actually have a podcast called Making the Argument, and one of the things that we go over a lot on that is intentions versus policy. In the legislature, we don't write intentions. We pass laws. We write laws, right? And it's the same thing with respect to some of the arguments that you see where there's a complete lack of intellectual consistency. And if you look at it, it actually fits within, and this is going to sound, well, I don't know, maybe it'll make sense, but if you actually look at Marxist ideology and you look at the Frankfurt School in Germany and you look at the way that they process information, right? Typically on our side, we look at things through a lens of the laws of logic, through rational inference, through the scientific method. That tends to be the way that we process information. Now, that's not to say that everybody of a conservative worldview does that or does it diligently. Yeah, we've got our own people that will throw all that out the window in order to make it, you know, an overly charged, emotionally charged argument or whatever it is. So I'm not saying that, you know, we're all pure on our side. But we at least feel the need to make sure that when we say something, it actually corresponds with reality. if you look at the left, yeah, when it's Stacey Abrams in Georgia, oh, that was all, you know, voter suppression, and 2016 was fraud and Russian interference, and that's why we shouldn't approve the Electoral College count, and that's why we need more investigations. But then when all of a sudden the shoe's on the other foot and they win, well, then the only possible reason that could have happened was because the American people have finally appreciated the brilliance of progressive ideology. And if you look at things like Marx, if you look at things like socialism, if you look at things like critical race theory, they value a postmodernist interpretation of reality over more of a traditional, you know, logically consistent view. In fact, you even saw this on a pamphlet that was put out at the Museum of African American History as part of the Smithsonian, where they actually described scientific and linear thinking as white. Now, I think that's about as racist a comment I've ever seen. Concepts like that are not white or black or brown or anything else. They're just concepts. They're available to everybody. Everybody uses them. But when you're willing to break down all of society into power structures, you're either an oppressor class or you're the oppressed class. And if you're either going to base that off of your socioeconomic status or you're going to base that off of your race, well, then all of a sudden, it's no longer about laying out a logical argument and you know, the law of identity and law of excluded middle and law of non-contradiction and using facts and evidence in order to make an inductive or a deductive argument. It's no longer about that. It's about your socioeconomic status or your skin color. That determines whether or not you're right or wrong on an issue. And if you take that sort of worldview, then you can make wildly inconsistent statements, wildly contradictory statements, and they're not contradictory, right? Because truth is relative. Well, how are we supposed to actually have a society where we can get along and we can actually arrive at truth, where we can actually look at a policy and evaluate it based off of facts and evidence and reason and trade-offs and come to a good conclusion? How can we do that if people are automatically excluded from the argument based off of how much money they make or who their parents were or what their skin color is? But if you're wondering why the Democrats can in 1 minute say with you know, a straight face that, oh, well, this election was fraud, and then this one over here is because we won is perfectly legitimate and fine and nothing bad could have happened, I think that's why. I think they have a completely different way on how they analyze information.
Yeah, you talked about it a little bit about Hollywood and everything else coming down on one side and being blatantly obvious which side they come down on. And it can be really, really disheartening to people that are conservative or people that's pro-gun when there was this huge thing going around that you're wrong. How do we stay motivated?
I mean, obviously winning helps, right? But it's like anything else. I was talking to a group a while back, and a lot of people were frustrated. They were despondent. I mean, we had lost a lot of political races here in Virginia. Legislation was getting passed that they didn't like, and a lot of people were, and they were questioning whether or not elections were actually being, you know, fairly monitored and tabulated. And so the whole idea was, you know, is it even worth fighting anymore? And the thing I always go back to is, I have a print in my office in Richmond, and it's of George Washington at Valley Forge. And I think anybody, most people are familiar with this print. It's the prayer at Valley Forge, right? So he's there with his horse, he's kneeling down, and he's praying. And I think most people look at that print, and what they see is George Washington, the first president of the United States, the victorious general of the Continental Army, the hero of Yorktown, the father of our country. That's what they see. That is not what that picture depicts. At that particular point in time, he was none of those things. He was a general that had lost almost every single battle. He had members of his own staff that were undermining him. Congress was looking for new ways to get rid of him. They weren't actually giving him the resources that he needed. He had to put down revolts within his own army. That is who he was in that moment. But he cared enough about what he was fighting for to pray and then get up and become the person that we all know and remember today. And so, quite frankly, I understand it can be difficult to be motivated. And I even had somebody ask me once, like, do you think there's any hope? Have we gone too far in the country? And my response back was, would it matter if we had? Would it matter with respect to what you're going to do with what I'm going to do? Would it matter if we had? Because if what we believe is true, then it's worth fighting for. I don't care if you're the last person left to do it. And as frustrating as things are right now, it is nowhere near as bad as it was at several other points in American history where American men and women got up and did what they had to do in order to defend what they loved. And so if you're not motivated by the fact that literally hundreds of thousands of Americans have died to make sure that we can have what we have in this country, if that's not motivation enough for you, quite frankly, I'm not going to pat you on the head and tell you you're special and beg you to go out there and fight. You fight for what you believe in. So I get that it's frustrating. I'm not taking anything away from that. But that should cause us to double down on our resolve. Because if you really want to send a message that we're not going away and we will continue to fight for this, no matter what the odds, no matter what the cost, that we believe in individual liberty, that we believe in self-determination, that we believe that the founding principles upon which this country was created are valuable and worth standing for, then you make a choice to defend it. You don't sit around waiting for someone to motivate you. You make a personal choice that I'm going to defend this no matter what happens. And that's one of the things that I feel like has been so frustrating to me to watch as Americans have now gotten into this loop where we're waiting for some the right politician's going to get elected and save it all. Really? That's not who we are. It's never been who we are. And I'm not waiting around. Look, I have a savior, right? I have a savior. I don't need one in politics. What I need to do is figure out the way I can have the most influence in order to fight, defend, and advance the principles that I love and I care about within the space I occupy. And if we can get more people to focus on that, as opposed to constantly looking around for some reason why they can't do more, then we're going to win. So that's what it comes down to. I understand the need to motivate people. I mean, in the military, leadership was about providing purpose, direction, and motivation to accomplish the mission. And I get that. But quite frankly, I want to see that traditional component of the American spirit that doesn't require somebody else to come along and say, this is worth fighting for, so let's go do it.
All right, that right there is motivational. In Loudoun County, there was a teacher that was teaching a high school civics class, and she was talking about the Second Amendment. This just came out a couple days ago, actually. And she was talking about how she disagreed with the Heller decision, which basically confirmed the individual right to bear arms. Mm-hmm. Her point was that is a new interpretation of the Second Amendment. And she told her students that the Supreme Court was wrong. And because the Supreme Court says that's what the Second Amendment says, doesn't make the Second Amendment actually say that. And she gave an assignment to her students to rewrite the Second Amendment. And she said if she had her way, she would cross off the right to bear arms. She would cross off the word right in the Second mm-hmm. Amendment. And that's a lot of what's going on in our schools. How do we mm-hmm. fight back the indoctrination of students in schools from teachers like that?
Take your kids out of public school. Take your kids out of the public school. I mean, look, I'm sorry. Once upon a time, I wouldn't have said that. I would have given you a long diatribe on all the various things that we can do legislatively in order to improve. I'm not doing it anymore. You want the honest truth? Here's the honest truth. In Virginia, we just passed new legislation, which is going to require teachers to go through cultural competency training. And you know what that's going to end up being. It's going to be a lot of critical race theory. It's going to be 1619 project stuff. That's what it's going to be. There was a black pastor who said it better than anyone I've ever heard of before. He said, you can't send your kids to Caesar for their education and be surprised when they come home as Romans. And that's what we have going on. And so, look, do I wish that we could have a system where instead of tax dollars just going from one government, you know, being taken from you and then going into a government agency where politicians get to decide what the curriculum and the school day looks like? Yes. Have I carried legislation to have tax dollars follow students? You bet I have, and I'll continue to do it. But at this point, we have to understand that government-administered schools are going to produce government-focused outcomes. And we have an entire generation of kids that they don't just get their education at school. And I'm willing to bet you, you're going to see more and more of a push to push healthcare through schools as well. So that kids go to school, that's where they eat, right? They get breakfast there, they get lunch there. Now all of a sudden we're sending food home. Despite all the different programs that we have in order to make sure that parents can feed their kids, now we're feeding children through the school system. And so you have a student that is going to school, they're being fed a particular worldview about the government's role within their life. The government's providing them with education. The government's providing them with food. I mean, my gosh, the government's their parent. The government's there to take care of them. The government's there to protect them. And then we're shocked when a teacher gets up there that went through numerous years of our higher education, where they were all fed a particular line about individual liberty, about the government's role in society. And then she is feeding them indoctrination on the Second Amendment. Because here's what's interesting about the Heller decision. This is not a new interpretation of the Second Amendment.
It's not.
Go read the Federalist Papers. Go read what the founders were saying about the Second Amendment. And I got in a debate once with somebody that was running against me for the House of Delegates. And she got up and she said, well-regulated militia. The Second Amendment says well-regulated militia. And I said, well, no, Anne. What the Second Amendment says is a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And there's two arguments made in that. The first part, which the left often uses as their justification for why only the militia or the National Guard or the police should have firearms, doesn't say that at all. It says a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. What that is the government acknowledging, and you got to understand the context from where this comes from, because Madison had read about previous republics, and he had read about the problems with standing armies. He'd read about the problems with mercenary armies. And he believed, as did most of our founders, they believed it was absolutely critical that the only way a free state could remain free was that the body politic was the main source for how you protected the state. And the only way the body politic could have that ability is with the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And so there are two arguments there. One is that inherent argument for a well-regulated militia, you know, again, being comprised of the body of the people, being necessary in order to secure the state itself, a free state. And then the second component of that argument is a recognition that you have an inherent right to be able to defend yourself, and that that right pre-exists government. And the thing that I love to bring up when a teacher or somebody else points something out, because typically their argument is not, I want to get rid of all guns. Typically what their argument is, well, not only the police and the military should have guns. Okay, well, let's explore that. Let's explore that reasoning for a moment. So what you're saying is private citizens shouldn't have guns because private citizens sometimes use guns to do bad things. Okay, let's apply that logic to the government. Has the government never used guns to do bad things? Because last time I checked, we're not hurting for examples on what happens when a government disarms the population and then decides to oppress them. You can look at the USSR, you can look at China, you can look at Venezuela. And in fact, if you want to look toward the West, go look at the colonial powers. Anyone else find it interesting that the same people in Europe, they used to have colonial empires, and when they moved into those colonial empires, what did they do? They disarmed the population so that nobody could stand up to them. Let's look at gun legislation and the history of gun control in the United States. How many gun laws did we have in the books under the Jim Crow South that were specifically designed to disarm law-abiding Black Americans so they couldn't defend themselves from a government that was oppressing them? So, again, the teacher is welcome to have their opinion, but they are now speaking from a position of authority to students on a topic for which they clearly do not understand, nor, last time I checked, was in their purview or curriculum to teach in the way that they're teaching it. But if you're asking me what the solution is to that, it's not another bill written by a state legislator. It just isn't. You can get more involved with your local school board. You can get more involved with your state legislature. That might help a little bit. But you want to know the one thing that you can do right now. And I realize Not everybody has the financial means to be able to do this. But you want to know the one thing you can do right now to remove your kids from a situation they're being indoctrinated in? Take your kid out of that school. Take your kid out of that environment. There's homeschool options. There's homeschool co-op options. There's private school options. There's scholarships for education. There's a number of ways that people can do it. And I'm working with parents right now in order to help them to do it. But again, unfortunately, and this is something that the left has done a very good job on. When we see something happening in a government institution like that, the left's solution is, well, then win an election and fix it. Okay, that is one approach. The other approach is you don't got to participate. I don't have to send my children to a school where they are either going to fail in their responsibilities or they're going to use my tax dollars to indoctrinate my children in a way that I think is inaccurate, incorrect, and in some cases immoral. So I took my kids out. And you know what? My kids have loved it. I've got an 18-year-old, I've got a 15-year-old, I've got a 13-year-old. We've done homeschool co-ops. We've done, you know, homeschool exclusively with my wife and I. There's all sorts of resources out there. You would be fascinated at how much easier it is to do this than it used to be and how many resources are available for little to no cost.
All right. Only a couple more questions. I want to pivot back to Virginia before I touch on your podcast a little bit. In Virginia, we passed a lot of anti-gun laws. We stopped a bunch of anti-gun laws, but we passed a lot of anti-gun laws. We got rid of preemption, for example, which is a whole mess in itself. We've installed red flag laws and universal background checks. How do we get rid of those now? Or is there a way that we can do it without taking back the legislature?
You can't get rid of the laws without taking back the legislature. And unless you could actually try it before a judge that has some semblance of what the Second Amendment means and what the various state constitutions mean as well. With respect to gun rights. So you can do it through the courts or you can do it through retaking your legislature. The easiest way, and that's not to say that it is an easy way, it's just the easiest way, is to install members of your legislature that will actually protect the Second Amendment, will roll back bad laws, and will actually put in protections. The other thing that we're getting down to right now is your local elections are really important. Your board of supervisors, your sheriff's elections are incredibly important. If you're in Virginia, your Commonwealth's attorney. If you're in another state, it might be your district attorney. Those are really important as well, because we do have a federalist system, and there is supposed to be, even when the state passes a law, that doesn't mean your local sheriff has to enforce it. Doesn't mean your local sheriff has to prioritize that state law, right? They get to allocate their resources in accordance with what they think is best for their community because they were elected to do that at the local office. They are a constitutional officer. And so a big part is your state legislature. A big part is your sheriff, your Commonwealth's attorney, your district attorneys. That's really important as well. Another part of it that, again, I think is really important goes back to that educational side, right? If you've got a friend that's not sure about guns or doesn't see what the big deal is and they've never been shooting, take them shooting. You know, take away the fear and the mystery that the press and that the left is constantly trying to impose on this issue and actually educate them so they can make a better decision. Because there is a point, right, and I'm not talking about violent resistance here, but there is a long history in this country of civil disobedience, of saying, look, I'm not going to go out and hurt somebody. I'm not going to go out and damage their property. But by the same token, I'm not going to comply with a law that I think is unjust and unconstitutional. I mean, the civil rights movement in this country was largely built upon peaceful civil disobedience and getting to a point where the government understood that just because it had the power to enforce something didn't make it just. And it adjusted the way that those politicians thought about things. And so there's going to have to be an all hands on deck approach when we come to this.
All right. Let's talk about your podcast. What is your podcast about? I've watched it and it's really good. It's really well produced. You got a good producer, I guess.
I do. I got to give Hamilton all the credit for that. He does a great job with all of our video editing and whatnot, and our social media management. We have two productions that we do. One is called Making the Argument with Nick Freitas, and that is largely where we're actually going to be recording another podcast today, and we're going to be talking about the PRO Act. But a big part of that, the takeaway from that podcast is we discuss an issue, and then we equip you with the arguments to make in order to argue in favor of the conservative perspective. Because what I've noticed is a lot of people, they know what they believe and they know why they believe it, maybe for experiential reasons or whatnot. But, you know, they're having a conversation with their kids, or the kid comes home from college, or something comes on the TV and they get asked a question. And again, they know why they believe what they believe, but they want more resources to be able to enhance that argument and make it something that's convincing to their friends and family. And so that's what Making the Argument is about. We're about equipping you with the arguments that you need to effectively advocate for the principles that you hold dear. And we talk about, like, so for instance, when we talk about the Second Amendment, one of the things I really emphasize on Making the Argument is it's not just a facts and figures game, right? Facts and figures are important. They are an important component of your argument. But there's also a moral component to your argument. And one of the things that we have failed on as conservatives, I think, in a lot of ways, is that we will argue for something in a manner where we say, do this because the stats show that we're correct, or do this because here's a chart which illustrates why this is beneficial to you economically or socially or whatever it is. Whereas the left makes an argument usually based off of emotionally charged rhetoric, right? They're appealing. You hear it all the time. We appeal to the head. They're appealing to the heart. What Making the Argument is about is appealing to both. It's not an either or proposition. When somebody has an emotional reaction to something, that emotional reaction is an invitation to thought. Because if you're truly compassionate and you truly care about something, you don't just react based off of your emotions. You use your emotions to motivate you to research, to understand, and then to support or implement policy that will actually address the problem that you care about. And that's what we do on Making the Argument. And usually in about a 20 to 40 minute segment, we will take complex issues. We'll break it down. We'll talk about the difference between intentions versus reality. We'll talk about the difference with the emotional argument, the intellectual argument, and the comprehensive argument. And then we equip them to do that. And then on the why minutes, that one is kind of more of an outreach component. So it's they're 2 to 3 minute episodes where we'll take a particular issue and we'll address it from a different angle. So for instance, on the gun issue, the why minute was, why do oppressive governments love gun control? And it was our most watched episode so far. We had hundreds of thousands of views and tens of thousands of interactions. And we didn't go through the typical argument on the Second Amendment. We looked at it from a different angle. And it was that one I articulated earlier, is that if your justification for taking guns out of the hands of private citizens is that sometimes private citizens use them to do bad things, well, then what's your justification for keeping them in the hands of the government? Because the government's done all sorts of horrible things with guns.
Wounded knee.
And so the list goes on, right? But it's about looking at sometimes old issues with a new perspective and giving some a new way to go about it and really trying to get that aha moment where maybe somebody can think about this, view what we've done, look at the illustrations that we've provided and look at it from a perspective they never considered before. And so, yeah, we have a lot of fun both with Making the Argument, which is the podcast, and the Why Minutes, which is our short video segments.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on and joining me on Virginia Reloaded. Thank you for everything that you do in the Commonwealth. You do make a difference. You do inspire people to go out there and defend the Second Amendment. And I just want to show you how grateful I am for that. And if you need anything from me, just let me know. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
No, hey, thanks very much for having me. And thanks for everything you guys do.
All right. Thank you. All right, that was Nick Freitas. Nick Freitas is a great guy. Go and give him support. We need more politicians in the state of Virginia and also nationwide like Nick that is dedicated to protecting the Second Amendment. And I encourage all of you to go check out his podcast and his videos. You will learn a lot. And he has dedicated his life to defending the Second Amendment. So we got to give him a little bit of love for that. All right. With that said, my name is John Crump. Check out Gun Owners of America at gunowners.org. There you can join, and you can even sign up for our email list. If you don't want to join, you can just get our email alerts and learn what's going on in your neck of the woods and beyond. And it's very, very helpful for us to be able to get that information out to you so you can help protect your rights. Because right now, it's not a time to sit on the bench and say, hey, I'm paying my $25 a year, so therefore, I don't have to do anything else. That can't be further from the truth. You need to get out there. You need to engage. You need to get involved. These are your rights. And if you don't fight for it, then what are they worth? Remember, my name is John Crump. Stay ever vigilant. Stay ever free. Keep in the fight. Remember, the Second Amendment is the only right that cannot be taken away. It can only be given away. So protect yours.
This has been Virginia Reloaded. A Gun Owners of America podcast. Tune in weekly for the latest gun news from the Commonwealth and beyond. Check out Gun Owners of America at gunowners.org.